find a place in the hearts of our children, and it won't leave.
Welcome back to your listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So we were talking about the importance of congregational prayers, and we were talking about some of the common excuses that are brought forth for not attending the congregational prayers, and we were going one by one through these excuses and giving the proper responses for them. Of course, we have said in many programs the incredible spiritual and worldly value of congregational prayers. And so we're trying to make sure that we can go to congregational prayers as often as we can. Now, sometimes the environment or the conditions really aren't such that we are able to go to congregational prayers, but the most beautiful thing about Islam is that it is flexible and it is practical. And so in perhaps today's age and time where it's truly difficult, or more than difficult, it's almost impossible to go to congregational prayers, perhaps because of the COVID situations. Well, in this situation, we can always do our congregational prayers at home with our family. Now, the last thing that people sometimes bring up is not really an excuse, but it is a quality or a characteristic. And this is that they are lazy or self-indulgent. And when it comes to the acts of worship, the acts of ubudiyah, they're kind of sluggish and languid and insolent, and they just don't care about these acts of worship. Now, always remember, dear friends, that these acts of worship, these forms of ubudiyah, of servitude to Allah, is what gets us close to Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. It is these very acts of worship that really creates a connection and a relationship between us, the servant, the created, and Allah, the Master, the Creator. And so we should take them seriously. We should really be eager to conduct and perform these acts of worship. Now, of course, you know, day one is not the same as, for example, day 10. The first day you might not feel so good, but then the second day you feel better, and then the third and fourth and so on, until truly you start to appreciate the value of these acts of worship, and you truly start to enjoy these acts of worship. And sometimes it might take days, sometimes it might take months, it might even take years. But the important thing is to continue to try, continue to do these acts of worship, whether they are the individual prayer or the congregational prayers, and thus we will be able to enhance our ubudiyah, our servitude of Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
European News Bulletin. Welcome back. I'm Saeed Bourza. We began with the Syrian war, in which several European countries have been involved and is now a decade old. Hundreds of thousands have been killed, millions displaced, and the country's infrastructure is on its knees. And as Murtaza Jaffa reports, the artillery fire may have largely quieted, but the campaign of regime change is still in play.
10 brutal years have passed in Syria. A decade of upheaval, conflict, and displacement, with no end in sight. While military campaigns have somewhat abated, the human suffering is reaching an all-time high. Western-backed groups suffered their greatest defeats in 2017 and 18. But since then, the US and the EU have ramped up economic sanctions designed to starve the country into regime change. Earlier in the week, EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell reiterated no end to sanctions, no normalization, and no support for reconstruction until a political transition. The effects have been harrowing. According to the World Food Programme, in the last year alone, millions of Syrians have fallen into severe levels of poverty. And with the global pandemic, the situation is bordering critical.
You have COVID, you have loss of the value of the currency itself, and then you have mass displacement. So when you put all of these things together, there is no surprise that we are seeing rising food insecurity, rising hunger. People are closer to starvation today than ever before.
According to the UN, the price of food is now 33 times higher than before the war, with an estimated 12.5 million people struggling to find enough food each day. Similar numbers can be found amongst the 5.6 million refugees now living in neighboring countries. Rates of suicide and self-harm are now beginning to rise.
I don't know what to think. The way I see my sisters and my parents, especially my mother, she has tried to hurt herself on more than one occasion. I did try one time too, to commit suicide. I went to the roof of this building. My father followed me. I was about to jump, and my father grabbed me. Our situation is very difficult.
The last 10 years have also seen efforts to find a political solution, with talks in Geneva, Vienna, and Doha. But if Western sanctions persist, then talks are ultimately futile. For many, any lasting resolution can only be brokered by the Syrians themselves. Only time will tell if or when this can be achieved.
Let's discuss that with Elijah Magnier. He's in Brussels. He's a veteran war correspondent joining me now. Good to have you on the show. What do you think of the Syrian people feeling after a decade of war in a country where even toothpaste is subject to sanctions?
Thank you for having me. Well, first of all, I think the Syrians realize that they are under harsh sanctions from the U.S., and the U.S. only is responsible for these sanctions, plus the EU, who are imposing sanctions on the Syrian population. The Americans are occupying northeast Syria, and they are preventing the Syrian government from using the oil that belongs to the Syrian, and it is stolen by the Americans. And not only that, it is a large part of the country that represents 23% of the geographic area of Syria, and it is one of the richest in agriculture. That is the main reason behind the suffering and the starvation of the population. Moreover, allow me to add something very important, which is the Western will to prevent the Syrian refugees from returning home. So what Mr. Borrell wants to say in his speech, as you rightly presented it, when he says five countries, five armies are in Syria, he forgot to say that the Turkey and Americans armies are occupying Syria. They were never invited into Syria. And what he's trying to say also, he is afraid of the elections. They don't want the return of the Syrian refugees. They handsomely paying the government of Turkey, of Lebanon, and Jordan to keep the Syrian refugee, so they don't return and they don't vote for their president. And this is exactly what they don't want to see, because they know President Assad is going to win.
It's been 10 years since the war began. What does the future hold for Syria, do you think? And do you have any hope at all in the various peace talks that have taken place up to now?
Well, the Americans stated very clearly, I mean, we just need to quote them. They said, we are there to make sure that the Russian will sink into the Syrian quagmire, and we are there to see the Russian failing in Syria. And we also want Assad to be removed. And then they say, we don't want a regime change. But in their action, they're preventing oil and food to reach Syria. So the population is very much aware of that. And people have no other choice but to wait and see when the Americans and the Europeans will understand that sanctions never worked. They've never worked on Venezuela, they didn't work on Iran, they're not working in Syria, they're not working in Lebanon, and this is not the way to change the regime. The only way to change regime is by the population who vote for their leaders. And we saw in Iran the sanctions since 1979, the Americans didn't achieve anything but the starvation of the population. Therefore, in Syria, no, I'm afraid there is no much hope because Biden is confused. There are no good solutions for Biden in Syria. He doesn't want to pull out from the borders with Iraq because he doesn't want to allow the Syrians to regain the commerce and the health they want to regain after all these years, 10 years of war. He doesn't want to pull out from the north Syria. He wants to keep the Turkey there that is occupying also northwest, and he wants to protect the Kurds. So he's not going to leave, and he wants to continue the same situation as it is and leave it.
As you say, sanctions. Ineffective, but convenient, perhaps. Elijah Magnier in Brussels, thank you. Moving on now to a joint military exercise conducted by Greece, Cyprus, Israel, and France in the eastern Mediterranean Sea in an effort to assert dominance over the region. Dubbed Noble Dina, the drills covered search-rescue operations, anti-submarine warfare, and scenarios simulating battle between warships. Greece and Cyprus are currently locked in a bitter dispute with Turkey over hydrocarbon resources in the disputed Mediterranean Sea. Top diplomats from France, Germany, Egypt, and Jordan have met to discuss possible peace efforts for Palestine and Israel ahead of upcoming elections. French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian said the next steps for Middle East peace depend on the outcome of the Israeli election on March 23rd. His comments come only weeks after the International Criminal Court announced it would be investigating alleged war crimes committed by Israeli forces. The Israeli regime has condemned the investigation as anti-Semitic. An EU study has found that the COVID-19 pandemic has wiped out approximately 6 million jobs across the bloc. The study says younger workers have experienced the sharpest decline in employment. Spain, France, Poland, Italy, and Greece were particularly affected as a result of economically suffocating lockdowns. According to the study, the pandemic has also disproportionately affected female-dominated sectors, including accommodation, food, and travel.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Days after that bombshell Oprah Winfrey interview involving two former members of the British royal family, Prince William, Queen Elizabeth's older grandson, has insisted that the royal family isn't full of racists. Richard Sudan joins me now with his take and the social media reaction. Richard, good evening.
Good evening, Saeed, and good to be with you again. Yes, so Prince William, possible future king of Britain, has made the first statement from the royal family following the bombshell claims in the interview with Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. And the statement by Prince William was made during a visit to a school, I think in East London. It's quite an interesting statement. People are talking about it.
They have said they're going to deal with the matter privately, Richard, but I don't think it's going to be possible.
Well, maybe not. And I think what's interesting is, arguably, if there wasn't damage to the royal family and their reputation, would Prince William have felt the need to answer the question from the journalist? You know, the language is a bit revealing as well, people are saying. Prince William said, very much not racist. Some people might say, you're just simply either racist or you're not. And actually, other people are asking the question, was it indeed Prince William who was alleged to have asked Harry about the skin colour of his future baby? Yeah. All questions that are up in the air, really. And just another point, there's an interesting picture actually circulating online of Prince William that people are really saying speaks for itself and speaks volumes about his perhaps track record or position on racism. And actually there's some interesting reactions online. In the regard of the picture we just saw, Saeed, there's an interesting reaction from Hector on Twitter, who says, only if Prince William knew that racism and white supremacy is not only expressed by words, deeds and actions are more than sufficient to identify those traits. And we have another reaction from Darkseid, who says, I don't know why the journalist asked Prince William, is the royal family a racist family? Did he really expect him to say anything but no? So a couple of reactions there, Saeed, but this discussion debate is raging online continually as we speak.
And we will be covering it moving forward. Let's take a look at your second story, Richard. Israel collaborating with the United Arab Emirates to develop anti-drone defense technology. What do we know about that?
Exactly. Well, of course, this is part of the increasing normalization deal that we've seen happen between the two countries. Israel's aerospace industries will work with the United Arab Emirates weapons maker Edge. And this was announced yesterday, and it was announced off the back of a phone call between Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed of Abu Dhabi. And, you know, they announced that these two companies will work together to develop quote-unquote anti-drone technology. But for most experts and analysts, this really translates as weapons development. And actually, you know, people have got a clear view, really, of the kinds of weapons and the purpose of which they'll be used for. There was the announcement of $10 billion worth of investment from the UAE to Israel in quote-unquote different sectors, and this is all off the back of this phone call between the two leaders. Now, what's really interesting is most people that have got a keen eye on what Israel has been doing has said, look, these weapons will undoubtedly or quite possibly end up being used you know, against the Palestinians who are occupied in their own country, you know, and this is acknowledged by international law and most serious human rights observers. And it's interesting that this announcement comes off the back of the recent announcement by the ICC that they are conducting a probe into possible alleged war crimes by Israel in the Gaza Strip and elsewhere. So this story has raised eyebrows and actually alarm bells for many people, say.
Let's hear from some of those people, Richard.
Absolutely. Let's go first to Samuel, who says, big story here, Israel Aerospace and the UAE Edge will cooperate on building anti-drone technology, and this is a warning shot to both Iran and Turkey. And we have a reaction on Twitter from Hassan Sajwani, who ironically says he tweets about counter-terrorism, and he seems to find it funny that Israel is developing more weapons with the UAE to potentially commit war crimes. And he says, imagine the UAE and Israel developing weapons together. Gaza will not sleep tonight. And would you believe, Saeed, Benjamin Netanyahu's son reacted to the tweet from Hassan Sajwani, and he expressed his support in the form of emojis, signaling his approval of a Twitter exchange, which frankly many people find very distasteful, to say the least.
Who would have thought, Richard? Richard Sudan with those stories. Richard, thank you. Human remains found in a woodland in Kent, a county in southeastern England, have been confirmed as those of Sarah Everard, a 33-year-old who was kidnapped and murdered, presumably by a serving British police officer. Amit Kabbala joins me now with more details and how social media has reacted to it all. Amit, good evening.
Good evening, Saeed. Yeah, it's a shocking story, and it sent shockwaves throughout the UK because just the gruesome nature of what's alleged to have happened. And there's this article by The Sun. Now, The Sun is a disreputable paper, so many will take what they say with a pinch of salt. But nonetheless, they say that the police officer who's been accused may have used his ID to entice the 33-year-old into the car and may have even used COVID regulations as a pretext, which shows a very malice intent in this crime. And this crime has shocked many, myself included, because as a man, I had no idea about the level of threat and danger that many women throughout the UK face. And because of the reactions on social media, because of the testimonies, very powerful testimonies that we've heard over the last couple of days, we found out that this is not an isolated incident, but many women are concerned for their safety when walking through the streets of Britain. And a recent YouGov poll actually backs this up, because it showed that 97% of young women have been sexually harassed in public space, and 80% of all women have been harassed. And what's interesting about this is that they don't feel, the same YouGov poll says they do not feel comfortable reporting this to the authorities because they do not believe that the authorities will take their concerns seriously. Now, this case involving a sitting Metropolitan Police officer is only going to exacerbate that lack of faith in the authorities to deal with sexual assaults. So we've got a fierce reaction on social media. We've got a tweet from Olivia. She says, "I think Sarah Everard really hits home with everyone and has taken over social media because we all know at least one person where a similar situation has happened to them. Enough is enough." Harriet Johnson, who is a barrister, says, "Every woman you know has taken a longer route, has doubled back on herself, has pretended to dawdle by a shop window, has had her keys in her hand, has made a phone call, has rounded a corner and run. Every woman you know has walked home scared. Every woman you know." And it really does speak to why this story has resonated with so many. And the UK, quite frankly, needs to do a lot more, particularly as it preaches to other nations around the world regarding women's rights, when clearly it needs to get its own house in order because women are telling us that they do not feel safe.
Reclaim these streets, Ahmed, is the hashtag that's been trending. It's now in the hands of the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, to allow that socially distanced vigil to be held for Sarah Everard. We'll wait and see if it will indeed go ahead Saturday. Now to your second story, an update on the case of Derek Chauvin, the now former police officer in Minneapolis, states, who stands accused of murdering George Floyd.
Yes, so the George Floyd trial will officially begin on the 29th of March. At the moment, they're in jury selection. And due to pressure by protesters and the prosecution, the judge presiding over the case has had to add third-degree murder to the second-degree murder charge, which means that there's more likely going to be a case of conviction. However, some are worried because we've seen high-profile cases in the past where it looked an open and shut case and the police officer involved has been acquitted. So some are skeptical because of the history of the jury siding with the police in this situation, particularly in the situation where the jury selection is done in a way where anyone that's been to a Black Lives Matter protest, anyone who is critical of Black Lives Matter or sympathetic to the traumatic experience George Floyd and his family have been through is likely to be dismissed. Now, you've got to ask yourself, who, unless you're living under a rock, who hasn't seen the death of George Floyd? Who hasn't probably been to a Black Lives Matter protest? So this is a way of kind of stacking the jury in favor of those that might have a sympathetic ear or perception to the police force. And there was actually a questionnaire issued out
that asked people, what do you think about Blue Lives Matter? And this is another way of kind of weeding out those that might reach a conclusion that the Minnesota Police Department might find unfavorable. Now, we've got some social media reaction. Jack says, breaking. Juror 36 notes that if George Floyd had complied with officers, this wouldn't have happened. And this juror was selected despite this comment. Candice Owens says, George Floyd had multiple autopsies performed and they all concluded the same. He did not die from compression to his throat. He was a drug addict who had enough drugs in him to overdose. The facts are that Derek Chauvin did not cause his death. Now, final tweet, we've got time. He says, please cite the multiple autopsies that concluded that, because multiple autopsies also concluded that the knee on the neck was a contributing factor, and two autopsies concluded the knee on the neck would have likely killed him without drugs in his system.
Ahmed Kamalo, thanks for all that. And that's all the time we have for this broadcast. Bye for now.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today.
We've begun discussing monotheism and the divine attributes in the last few episodes. Shiite scholars believe that God is one, in contrast to other religions such as Christianity.
He's completely immaterial being.
We don't believe that in the Trinity and that there's three dimensions to God, Holy Spirit, Jesus, and God. We don't believe that he's a physical body. Also, in contrast to other sects in Islam, within Islam, Shiism doesn't believe that God is a physical body. We believe that he has absolute power. He has absolute knowledge. Also, the verses of the Holy Quran in which physical attributes have been ascribed to God, such as having a hand, and so on and so forth. We don't take these literally. We interpret them in a different way, in contrast to other sects within Islam. This is very important, and we're going to be repeating this throughout all of our episodes. It's necessary to make this clear. So even if you see such expressions as the hand of God, it's important not to take this literally, because God doesn't have human-like characteristics, such as a physical body.
Today we're going to be examining a question and a problem which is very important. And that problem is related to a category of God's attributes which have been mentioned in the Quran and the traditions, which have led to differences of opinion amongst the Muslims, and specifically amongst the scholars who have attempted to interpret these traditions and these verses of the Holy Quran and these attributes of God. To explain, there's a series of attributes in the Quran which, if we didn't know that the Quran and the traditions had mentioned them, we would have categorically denied them. For example, in Surah Rahman, verse 27, God Almighty says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, وَيَبْقَى وَجْهُ رَبِّكَ ذُو الْجَلَالِ وَالْإِكْرَامِ, and the face of your Lord will remain, the possessor of majesty and nobility. In this verse, we see that God Almighty has described himself as having a face. Or, for example, in Surah Sa'd, verse 75, God Almighty says, خَلَقْتُ بِيَدَيَّ, I created with my two hands. So in this verse, we see that God Almighty has been described as having two hands. In the previous verse, he's been described as having a face. There are also many traditions which describe God as having certain bodily parts, Right now, we're not concerned with the whether or not these traditions are authentic and reliable or not. But if not anything, we can't deny the fact that some of these things have been mentioned, some of these attributes have been mentioned in the Holy Quran, and so therefore they're undeniable. It created a problem for them in the sense that we know that the intellect says that God cannot be something physical in nature. It's also something that's been affirmed in religion through the Quran and the traditions. At the same time, God is describing himself with these attributes. In response to this problem and this paradox, various theories have been put forward. For example, some of the theologians said that God has a face, and he has hands, and just like we do. In fact, some of them went to the extreme of saying that it's possible to shake God's hand, or it's possible to hug God, you know. And just like you could hug your brother in faith, or your mother, or your father, you could also do that in this world and in the hereafter if you reach the level of sincerity towards him. This is a theory, obviously, that doesn't deserve any serious consideration, keeping in mind the fact that God is not a physical body, and this is something which is simply impossible. Another group of theologians said that we affirm that these attributes for God in the exact same meaning that they have when they're used for human beings and other creatures. However, in order to avoid the problem that the first group did, who said that God possesses these things as any other physical being would, these people added the clause that he possesses these things in the exact same way that we do, only in a way that's dissimilar and different from the way we do. In Arabic, they said, "Bila tashbihin wala takif," in a way that's not similar to us and in a with a quality that's not similar to ours, in order to avoid the aforementioned problem. Now, this theory also is something that doesn't deserve any scholarly consideration, considering the fact that it's a contradiction and therefore wrong. Thank you for joining us here today on The Key, where we're looking at God's attributes. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. in the limelight.
British women flooded social media with posts about the steps they take when out alone at night to keep safe, including clutching keys to use as a weapon and wearing trainers to help them run. Many raged at the violence against women that made them feel they had to take such measures. I prepare for you an article written jointly by Michael Holden and David Milliken under the heading, London Murder Case Triggers Wave of Grief, Rage Over Threats to Women. The article has been published by the Reuters News Agency. Please stay with us for more of Michael Holden and David Milliken's article. Women in Britain poured out their fears and anger over how unsafe they feel walking the streets after the disappearance of a woman in Clapham, South London, and the arrest of a police officer on suspicion of a kidnap and murder. Sarah Everard, a 33-year-old, was last seen at 9:30 p.m. local time on 3rd of March as she walked home from a friend's house in South London. Her image, smiling at the camera or caught on CCTV that evening, has been splashed across British newspapers all week. Anxiety turned to grief after news late on Wednesday, 3rd of March, that police investigating Everard's disappearance had found remains in a wood outside London, resulting in an outpouring of personal accounts by women of their own experiences and fears. Anna Burley, a 31-year-old, one of the organisers of a planned Reclaim These Streets vigil to honour Sarah Everard and demand change, said, "The disappearance of Sarah and the absolute tragedy around that has really touched a nerve with a lot of women." Anna Burley said, "We feel really angry that it's an expectation put on women that we need to change our behaviour to stay safe. The problem isn't women. The problem is that women aren't safe on our streets." Women flooded social media with posts about the steps they take when out alone at night to keep safe, including clutching keys to use as a weapon and wearing trainers to help them run. Many raged at the violence against women that made them feel they had to take such measures. Others detailed a catalogue of incidents of harassment by men in public over the decades since they were schoolgirls. Britain's Home Secretary Priti Patel said, "These are so powerful because each and every woman can relate," adding, "Every woman should feel safe to walk on our streets without fear of harassment or violence." Legislator Jess Phillips, the opposition Labour Party's policy chief on domestic violence, read out in the Chamber of the House of Commons the names of all 118 women murdered by men in the United Kingdom last year. Jessica Phillips said, "The message that needs to be sent is that male violence is something that has to be tackled and challenged, and the justice system and society has to wake up to that." The head of London's police force, Cressida Dick, said she and her colleagues were utterly appalled at news that a police officer had been arrested in connection with Sarah Everard's abduction, sparking a wave of shock and anger. Police on Thursday, 4th of March, were given extra time to question the officer, whose job is to guard diplomatic buildings, on suspicion of kidnap, murder, and indecent exposure. A woman in her 30s, whom media reports said was his wife, was also detained on suspicion of assisting an offender, but has since been released on police bail. England's police watchdog, the Independent Office for Police Conduct, said it had launched an investigation into the London Police Force's handling of the case. The arrested police officer was reported to police on 28th of February over charges of indecent exposure in a South London fast food restaurant, several days before Sarah Everard's disappearance. The watchdog also said it would look closer at how the suspect sustained head injuries that required hospital treatment, which police said occurred whilst he was alone in his prison cell. Of London's police force, Cressida Dix, sought to reassure women, claiming it was incredibly rare for a woman to be abducted from the streets. She said, "But I completely understand that despite this, women in London and the wider public, particularly those in the area where Sarah went missing, will be worried and may well be feeling scared." Although the remains have not yet been formally identified, Sarah Everard's family paid tribute, saying their daughter Sarah was taken from us, and we're appealing for any information that will help to solve this terrible crime. The family said in a statement, "Sarah was a wonderful daughter and sister. She was kind and thoughtful, caring and dependable." Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson said he was shocked and deeply saddened by developments in this case. The Reclaim These Streets vigil will take place in coming days in Clapham Common in southwest London, near where Sarah Everard was last seen. The event's organiser wrote on Facebook, "We believe that streets should be safe for women regardless of what you wear, where you live, or what time of the day or night it is." The statement added, "It's wrong that the response to violence against women requires women to behave differently." In comments on social media, women have also been offering to help each other walk together to the event in groups to keep each other safe. Organisers of the Clapham Common Vigil said that police officers had told them the event would not be allowed given current COVID-19 restrictions. Writing on a crowdfunding website to cover legal fees, organisers said they were working with human rights lawyers to challenge the Metropolitan Police's interpretation of coronavirus legislation and are seeking an urgent order from the High Court for the event to go ahead.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, we send our peace and blessings upon all the prophets of Allah, subhanahu wa ta'ala, and especially the last of them, Muhammad al-Mustafa and his progeny, and those companions who followed their path. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi, and welcome to another program of For a Better Life, here on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about psychological diseases and social issues, social problems that we might have in the society and within ourselves, and that many of us may turn to drugs, alcohol, workaholism, and other means, other isms that will take us away, make us avoid these difficulties. But in fact, what it does, it's an evil cycle, where every one of us will be deprived. Number one, we will inflict harm towards our health. Two, our mental health. Number three, our spiritual health. And even harm those who we love. So these drugs just makes it worse. And we are finding ourselves in an evil cycle where as soon as the drugs effect diminishes, we see that we cannot face the difficulties. And we turn towards the drug again and again. And we find ourselves in an evil cycle. Some kinds of daydreaming and the use of alcohol are similar in regard to the escape from problems. Of course, the use of alcohol is physically more harmful. In these two kinds of escape, the person does not attempt to solve the difficulty by the means of reasoning. Rather, we want to evade it. We want to escape from it. We want to avoid it. And since the escape cannot be permanent, we are forced to return to the real world in a state of greater disharmony and anguish. Firru ilallah. Escape to Allah. Run towards Allah. That is the only thing that would give us serenity and peace. And I will inshallah talk more about it going a little bit further in the program. A person's thoughts and ideas exercise a profound influence on our spiritual well-being. Our progress and backwardness, and in a word, our spiritual qualities depend on our way of thinking. Various factors have an effect on one's way of thinking and looking at things. One who enjoys an active intellect has the ability to obtain material resources and derive benefit from the external world. The world does not appear to that person who has the intellectual capacity, who has peace and serenity and is happy and has joy. The world does not appear to that person to be dark and frightful. Rather, that person immediately closes the windows of the spirit that face external things and turns to the enjoyment of spiritual pleasures. Spiritual pleasures, dear brothers and sisters. Thereby, when that person takes himself or herself into a world free from the bondage of suffering, and where he can saturate himself, satisfy himself with the cup of felicity and peace. However, those who are short-sighted seek refuge in external means in order to seek freedom from the chains of anguish. We seek freedom in a woman, in a man, in our spouse, in our children, in our material wealth, in our car, in our career, in our job and work, and so on and so forth. These are all veils. We should seek refuge in Allah only. And we Muslims always say, A'udhu billah. I seek refuge in Allah. A'udhu billah. I seek refuge in Allah. From everything else and anything else.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
We see that some of us who are short-sighted seek refuge in external means in order to seek that freedom in its total meaning, in its absolute sense. Because, on the one hand, man's wishes and desires are in a state of perpetual change, and on the other, there is nothing permanent and enduring in this turbulent world. Should man's happiness depend on external things, it would always be prone to destruction. Therefore, dear brothers and sisters, such a person is like a drowning man, which clings to everything that he can catch, hold, but which cannot save him. So you're drowning and you're trying to hold something that might help you, save you. Ultimately, nothing that is transitory, that is impermanent, can give us true peace and freedom. A scholar by the name of Carlos describes the wretchedness of this group of people in these words. One abandons his beautiful mansion in order to escape the difficulties of his life and fruitlessly takes resort in various means. Another person speedily runs away from his wife and children like a fire engine hastening to extinguish a fire. But as soon as he reaches his destination, he again comes face to face with his enemy. Spiritual boredom. Thereat, he goes back with the same haste that he had gone forth, confounded and lost like a madman. These were the words of Carlos. The profound effect of suffering is severe, dear brothers and sisters, and we should not underestimate this profound effect of suffering, mental suffering, that we are talking about right now. Basically, man's creation is such that he is compelled to bear a lot of physical and spiritual hardships in order to satisfy the needs of his life, because it is in the course of this toil and hardship and endeavor for obtaining the material means of life that his intellectual and spiritual faculties acquire their growth. Without any difficulties, dear brothers and sisters, we would not evolve. We would not develop, neither spiritually, nor mentally, nor physically.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. All I need, it's all I need, all I need, all I need, all I need, oh, 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 oh. All I need, to be all I need, and I know that you see how much you need. You mean to me, 'cause your love is all I need, to be all I can be. I know that you see how much you mean to me.
Your love is all I need.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.